I'd like to welcome you to the 2009 Public Lecture for the Students for Development Award. Before we get started, we're really going to let the recipients of this year's award do all the talking. This is their opportunity to share their experiences from the last summer. But before we do that, I just wanted to give a little bit of background on what the AUCC Students for Development Award is and about what AUCC is. So essentially, the Students for Development program was launched in 2005, and it provides opportunities to upper-year students, so third-year undergraduates all the way up to PhD level, to pursue opportunities, internships in developing countries in the areas of governance, health, and environmental sustainability. And the internships are a minimum of 3 months, so they are meant to be somewhat long-term placements. By the end of this year, so by the end of 2010, CETA will have contributed $10 million to the program, and AUCC and the partner universities will have contributed $3 million to the effort. And over the past 5 years, there have been 735 Canadian students from 72 Canadian universities who have done these internships. They have worked with 462 partner organizations in 82 developing countries. And all students who do these internships are asked to come back and do public engagement activities in an effort to kind of increase the knowledge sharing based on their internships and the areas in which they were working. In 2009, so this past summer, these students were part of a kind of new version of the Students for Development program, and that was that they added the additional focuses of gender, environmental sustainability, and health to the initial mandate of focusing on governance. So today, when you hear them speak about their internships, they'll be a little bit more varied than they were in the past, and that's a new focus of AUCC. And if there are questions, we're going to have a question and answer period at the end, but if you have questions specifically about the Students for Development Award and how you can apply, we can let you know right now that approval for funding for the award is done on a yearly basis, and so we're waiting for the final confirmation for the 2010 round. But information about the award is always posted on our website, so it's the Internship Offices Network of McGill. If you do go to www.mcgill.ca/internships, you can find all the information there about deadlines and eligibility, and the students here on the panel will be able to answer your questions more specifically about the actual internships, the work, and those things. So we'll begin just by quickly introducing the nine panelists, and I'll let Sarah do that.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Wolf, and I'm one of the eight recipients of the award from this year. And I'm just going to quickly introduce all of the panelists and what internships we did this summer. So Annalise Miller is a Arts U3 student in Arts and Science, majoring in Environment and minoring in Geography. Annalise interned at the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation in Agriculture in Barbados, an organization which encourages and supports the development of sustainable agriculture, food security, and rural prosperity in the Americas. During her internship, she conducted a feasibility study on the economic benefits of home gardening to alleviate food insecurity, created educational materials on sustainable gardening techniques and on the health benefits of domestic food production, in addition to giving promotional talks to local stakeholders and NGOs. Justin Dubois is a law student. Justin did his internship with the Refugee Law Project in Kampala, Uganda, as an organization that seeks to ensure the respect of the fundamental human rights of all forced migrants to the country. He helped in the organization's mandate to offer free legal aid to refugees, both in Kampala and in the refugee settlements in West Nile, by following up cases with government authorities, aid organizations, and the police. May Nam is a law student. The rights and welfare of female migrant workers are issues close to May's heart. In Montreal, she is active with migrant workers' rights through the Philippine Women's Center of Quebec, an organization she helped form in 2006. This past summer, she worked at the Ateneo Human Rights Center in Manila, Philippines. The AHRC represents victims of human rights violations and produces scholarship on human rights and law in the Philippines. Janine Plamondon is a law student. Janine was a legal intern in the Appeals and Legal Advisory Division in the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in Arusha, Tanzania. In this capacity, she worked on two cases, the prosecutor versus Prote Zigi Rani Razo, convicted of genocide, and the prosecutor versus Leonidas Nishigoza, convicted of contempt of court. Vladi Ivanov is a U3 art student with focusing in honors international development studies, a minor in international relations and Middle East languages. Vladi interned at the Indigenous Peoples of Africa Coordinating Committee, a network of indigenous peoples groups throughout Africa. She worked mainly at the Secretariat headquarters in Cape Town, South Africa, and also assisted IPACC at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in New York, and helped organize and deliver a human rights and women's indigenous leadership training meeting in Bamako, Mali. Denise Vanderkamp is in the Faculty of Arts doing a Master's of Poli-Sci. Denise interned at Future Generations China, an environmental NGO in China that promotes public health and sustainable development through community training. In this role, she worked with local environmental groups to undertake a nationwide survey on energy-saving programs in rural communities. Prior to beginning her master's at McGill, Denise worked with grassroots environmental organizations in China for 2 years and has since developed a strong research interest in the interaction between civil society and NGOs and the realities of development at the grassroots. Jacob Fox is an art student majoring in economics and a minor in history. This summer, Jacob interned with the socioeconomic unit of G-Power NGO, an organization that facilitates community-based micro-hydroelectric projects in rural Kenya. Among other activities, Jacob worked on the NGO's carbon credit program and undertook field research on local agriculture. And my name is Sarah Wolf. I am a U2 art student majoring in poli-sci and women's studies. My summer internship was a joint venture between the Canadian charity End Poverty Now and the Rwanda Village Concept Project, which is a Rwandan student-run NGO, and it was to evaluate a microfinance project in Huye, Rwanda. I worked with the women of a widow's association in a sustainable beekeeping enterprise, an experience that blended my academic interests in gender, development, and economics. So I'd like to turn things over to the governance section of our lecture. Thank you.
Bonjour. I'm going to speak in French, and I hope if there's questions afterwards, feel free to ask them. Je m'appelle Justin, et j'ai la chance d'avoir à mes côtés Vladi et Janine. Et comme on peut le voir, nous allons parler de la gouvernance. Mais ce n'est vraiment pas notre objectif de vous parler, de théoriser c'est quoi au juste la gouvernance, ou vraiment d'énumérer les 8 conditions nécessaires à la bonne gouvernance établie par les Nations Unies dans leur rapport le plus récent. Plutôt, notre objectif, c'est d'amener des réalités de gouvernance un peu plus près pour vous, un peu plus près alors, des expériences qu'on a vécues cet été, pour concrétiser vraiment le concept ou la notion un peu plus académique de ce que c'est. Puis on commence avec ça. Pour nous, la gouvernance, plus qu'autre chose, c'est quand même un concept très, très flou. Et c'est une raison pour laquelle on ne veut pas théoriser pour quelques minutes ce que ça veut dire. Puis aussi parce que je ne pense pas que ça serait très intéressant pour vous et pas très intéressant pour nous non plus. Alors, pour nous, vraiment, c'est juste de s'assurer que la gouvernance, c'est s'assurer que les choses fonctionnent. So, just making things work. C'est une façon qui est juste et équitable. Mais comme on peut voir déjà, il y a un problème de savoir qu'est-ce que « fonctionner » veut dire, et aussi, pour différentes personnes dans différents environnements, ce que « juste et équitable » veut vraiment dire. Alors, pour concrétiser, comme j'ai dit, un peu le concept, nous allons prendre une photo qui va être source d'inspiration pour notre petite anecdote. Alors, moi, ici, j'ai une photo d'une foule de réfugiés à l'extérieur des locaux du Refugee Law Project. Et c'est une photo, comme on peut voir, la foule est quand même assez grande. Et les réfugiés attendent l'ouverture du bureau à 9h le matin pour qu'ils puissent entrer et avoir un rendez-vous soit avec un conseiller pour du soutien psychosocial ou avec un avocat pour de l'aide juridique. Alors, juste pour un peu de background de l'organisation, le Refugee Law Project a 5 ou 6 avocats, dépendamment du temps, et 6 ou 7 conseillers. quand il y a une soixantaine, 70 personnes qui attendent pour des rendez-vous, c'est quand même un manque de ressources. La première journée que je suis arrivé à mon stage, il y avait eu un incendie au premier étage qui a causé une panne d'électricité, qui voulait dire que rien fonctionnait, qui voulait dire que personne ne pouvait voir les clients, les réfugiés. Puis je soulève ces deux événements juste pour démontrer que vraiment, on n'y pense pas souvent, mais un grand défi à la gouvernance, puis pas seulement en Ouganda, pas seulement avec le Refugee Law Project, mais aussi au Canada sur une différente échelle, c'est un manque de ressources. Et c'est un manque de ressources qui est bien ciblé aussi. Alors, pour contrer ces quelques anecdotes de manque de ressources, de l'autre côté, il y a un programme à Kampala où le Haut Commissariat pour les réfugiés, le UNHCR, a offert ou finance une branche spécialisée de la police pour faire affaire avec les problèmes des réfugiés. Et plutôt que d'entrer dans le système traditionnel de justice, on fait appel à des leaders traditionnels des communautés de réfugiés pour qu'ils puissent ensemble, quand il y a un problème, régler, trouver une solution plutôt communautaire qui implique le gouvernement, mais qui implique aussi les réfugiés comme tels et la communauté de réfugiés. C'est un peu comme des notions de concept de justice traditionnelle. Et puis, c'est un programme qui est financé par le Haut Commissariat. Alors, on peut voir que si les ressources sont bien placées, on peut avoir des améliorations dans le système de gouvernance.
Okay, I'm Janine Flamondon, and the experience I wanted to talk about was one of the most powerful experiences for me. I attended the judgment and sentencing of Kalix Kalamanzira, who was the interior minister in the government of Rwanda at the time of the genocide, and he was found guilty of genocide and public incitement to commit genocide and sentenced to 30 years in prison. And it was very powerful to be there and to see the accused in front of me and to also see a representative or three representatives, the judges, of the international community who were basically saying what happened in Rwanda was wrong and we are holding you personally accountable for your position of authority and the fact that you abused that authority, and as a result, he was sentenced to 30 years in jail. And it really made, for me, it was a very emotional moment, and it made the Rwandan genocide a very real experience as opposed to simply an academic exercise or a theoretical kind of discussion of what went wrong and how can we fix it. I think that moment also, to me, sort of embodies some of the challenges involved with governance because, for example, all of the people sitting watching this emotional moment of judgment were mainly white lawyers from Western countries as opposed to Rwandan citizens. It can also be problematic to hold an individual responsible when they are acts of collective violence. And the final challenge that it sort of posed for me, now I can't think of it. But nevertheless, I think it was a powerful and important moment in bringing home for me like the effects of the genocide and moving past it and establishing governance in Rwanda.
Okay. So when I was with IPAC, I went with them to the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in New York, and IPAC is a network of a bunch of different indigenous peoples organizations in Africa. And at the UN Forum, it actually framed itself as the representative for the entire African Indigenous Caucus that spoke for the interests of African Indigenous peoples. And as such, it drafted the African Caucus Statement and so on and so forth. And this isn't entirely without basis because IPAC, as far as indigenous organizations in Africa go, has the broadest constituency and it internally tries to operate on democratic principles. But during one meeting of the African Caucus that I attended, but my supervisor, the director of the Secretariat of IPAC, wasn't present. Basically, a leader of an indigenous organization from Kenya basically said that he doesn't recognize IPAC as being legitimate to represent the African Caucus, and that he believes that the director of the Secretariat of this organization that I was working for is manipulating resources that are meant for indigenous peoples. So this kind of brought up a few issues for me personally observing this, because it really made me realize at the time that legitimacy issues. Legitimacy, I mean, itself feeds into good governance in a huge way, because without legitimacy and whatever that entails, there can't really be good governance, because people need to feel like they're being represented legitimately and by people who they trust to represent their interests. So we tend to think of legitimacy problems as being within the state context, but it really showed me that civil society groups have huge problems with regards to legitimacy as well, and we really need to look at the mandates and motivations of civil society groups if we are to achieve this legitimacy and so-called good governance.
Le cirque, quelques mots. Évidemment, ce sont des conditions qui sont assez claires, je pense, pour la plupart des gens, des choses nécessaires pour la bonne gouvernance. Mais vraiment, en se parlant, et puis des conclusions qu'on a tirées, c'est comme Vladi a dit, vraiment la légitimité est essentielle. Et puis aussi, on a trouvé que ce sont surtout des processus organiques qui viennent de la société civile, qui assurent des mouvements pour l'amélioration de la gouvernance, mais aussi de la situation sur le terrain pour la plupart des gens. Alors, c'est ça.
Hi, so again, my name is Annalise, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about sustainability. So what do we really mean when we talk about environmental sustainability and sustainable development? Well, the two terms themselves are actually quite intricately related, and they're very much centered on the ability to meet the needs of the present generation without compromising the needs of future generations, the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So many of these needs, and requirements like clean air, clean water, stream flow, and so on, come from our surrounding environment. And thus, therefore, environmental sustainability and sustainable development are quite logical and mean much more than actually protecting just natural resources, but instead about protecting, enhancing the ability and of services and processes by which the natural environment provides these services to both humans and ecosystems. So when talking about this in frame of development, what does actually environmental sustainability mean? Well, many economic, political, and ecological problems that the world faces today, and most especially that developing nations face, are the result of development trajectories that have favored short-term economic and social benefits over longer-term environmental management practices. Aligning environmental interests with those of economic development is actually only logical, because ensuring environmental sustainability has many economic, social, political, and health benefits. Ecosystem services like river flow, rainfall, and solar energy can be harnessed for profit, as they can be used to generate electricity, for instance, through micro hydroelectric dam projects. Some of these same services can also be used in a rainwater irrigated home garden system to produce food, allowing for families to both save money on their food bills and improve their health. Furthermore, integrating environmental sustainability into development plans also ensures that projects are properly suited to the local context and therefore take into consideration resources, the local resources and their limitations. So acknowledging the limits of a community's ability and therefore their environment's ability to provide services also allows for smarter and much more secure development plans in the longer term. And of course, most obviously, there are many health benefits of ensuring environmental sustainability through pollution reduction, environmental beautification, and so on and so forth. So from a personal note, one of the most important lessons that I actually learned through my internship in Barbados relates directly to the concepts of environmental sustainability and sustainable development that I've just been explaining. Apologies. what I'm referring to is actually this ability to approach an environmental challenge from many different angles. I have learned that the most successful environmental projects are those that actually view a problem, its solutions, and also ways to promote environmental projects in a much more holistic way than just purely centering on environmental side of things. My own experiences in Barbados promoting home gardens to alleviate food security is really much a perfect example of this, as home gardening is more than just the environmental benefits of reducing imported food and therefore carbon emissions. It is much more important than that. It has multiple other positive spin-off effects of improving health by encouraging fruit and vegetable consumption, and also significant financial savings by reducing costs of food. The financial and health benefits are the biggest sell point on this side, especially in light of Barbados' high food insecurity and its elevated rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes. And one of the most incredible experiences would be able to communicate these numerous benefits and this holistic approach to NGOs, and to see that they embrace the project, take it on as their own, and then move forward by not just viewing it as purely economic, purely health, or purely social.
So I want to tell a story about environmental sustainability and the importance of ownership and leadership in advancing this. It came out of my experience of working with Future Generations, an NGO that works with community development in environmental protection in China. So as Annalise highlighted earlier, environmental sustainability can be a somewhat intangible concept because it's about the long term and preserving resources for the long term. And in poor rural areas, you find that people aren't as invested in it because they're more concerned with immediate needs, like putting food on the table. So they don't want to entertain projects that have to make them think about the long term or focus on long term issues. And through my experiences of working with Future Generations, I found that one way to mitigate this was the presence of a very experimental and well-respected leader within a community. So, for example, my internship took me to a village in rural northern China in Liaoning province, where the local government was trying to introduce a biogas project where people burn animal waste to produce cooking fuel instead of burning firewood so they could help protect the forests in that area. And many of the villagers, when they heard about this project, were somewhat reticent because it was messy, it seemed problematic, they weren't sure if it could work. But one man, Mr. Jing Changshun, he's the man who you see doing the community mapping there, he had been thinking a lot about how his use of firewood was damaging the forests. He saw the depletion of the forest, and he was worried about how this might impact the rural livelihood. So he decided to go ahead and undertake this biogas project, and part of his calculation was, I can save money. And once he implemented it, he noticed a lot of his neighbors started dropping by trying to check out how this new stove worked, and they were very interested, and they noticed how much firewood he was saving. And when he saw their interest, he took the initiative, with the help of our NGO, to raise awareness about the benefits of using biogas, reducing the use of firewood, and he helped to train leaders in fellow communities in how to take ownership of this project and develop it further. So, and in fact, he was so successful in this leadership role that later when the local government wanted to introduce a new project, they turned to him to introduce it, and they asked him to speak to villages to introduce it because they recognized the power of his leadership. So I think this story is very inspiring because it can convince those of us who are unsure about how much you can promote this idea of environmental sustainability in rural areas. It convinces us that it is possible, even though other concerns may seem more prevalent in these communities. Thank you.
I just want to tell a brief anecdote, sort of that has to do with partnership with local communities and the importance of that, in this case, in environmental sustainability projects. There was a time this summer when I was working on a publication for my host organization for general awareness, advertising purposes. And one day I found out that I would have to meet with the local community members just to, what I thought, it was going over the publication and making sure everything was okay. And I thought it would be short. That was a bad assumption because it took about 3 to 4 hours, and that was 3 to 4 hours of focusing mainly on the first page and two words on the first page. And this was something that I thought was a trivial issue, and I guess from the perspective maybe of being fluent in English or coming from the West, it seemed obvious to me what needed to happen. However, it ended up becoming a very heated argument, and words started being thrown about in Kikuyu, which I didn't understand, so I had to take a back seat. Overall, however, what I learned from this was how important it was to the local community that they were represented, and that their what they saw as their accomplishments were represented in the depiction of the project. So I realized that what's really important is portraying an equal partnership. And a lot of these projects with environmental sustainability involve a certain amount of technical expertise. I mean, I was working for an organization that builds micro hydroelectric dams. It involves a certain amount of engineering and technical know-how. In truth, it is not an equal partnership. However, in order for the project to be successful, for the community to feel like they have a stake in it and to work on it, there needs to be that environment of equal partnership in order to achieve the ends. So, thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mei Jane M. I'm a student here at the law faculty, and I'm going to talk a little bit about gender, which is the cross-cutting theme. Since gender is and gender and women's empowerment are intrinsically linked to the broad areas of good governance, environmental sustainability, and health, it's been recognized by the student development program to be a very big concern. So I spent 4 months at the Ateneo Human Rights Center. I have here posted the mandate, so you can see a little bit what it is they do there. Since I myself am of the Philippine diaspora and have been heavily involved with the Philippine community in Canada, I was able to launch into some very interesting projects without having to spend more time adapting to culture and language and history. And I was able to do three especially interesting projects that had a strong gender component. And I learned three sort of lessons from these projects. I learned first the importance of judicial accountability and gender sensitivity training for the judiciary. Also, I learned the distance between international human rights instruments and the realities of people on the ground at times and problems with enforcement of these instruments. And finally, I also learned or saw some of the challenges of pushing the boundaries of gender to go beyond merely women's empowerment, but to look at it in a much more complex way. So the first project that I'm going to talk about was a gender sensitivity training workshop that I helped prepare training materials for. And this involved me examining some cases by the Supreme Court, well, all the cases from 2006 and 2007, and to go through them and look for gender components and to develop summaries for judges on sort of the strengths and weaknesses with a gender perspective. And part of my work entailed me going to an actual judicial training session on gender sensitivity and the UN Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, also known as CEDA. And it was there that I got to interact with judges and to hear what they thought about the training. And I have a clip here. I also do some radio work, so here's a clip that I made. This is a regional court level judge speaking. Her name was Patsy Sirmento Gomundan. So here's just a little clip.
And do you think that these kind of trainings are helping other judges, your colleagues as well? And how is it helping them?
It actually raises the level of consciousness among judges in the way that they would formulate their decisions, in the way that they would consider that there should actually be equality germane to particular circumstances of male and female, and putting that into action in the decisions that they formulate.
Okay, so the second project I wanted to share with you was a report I compiled for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is a regional international body, like the UN type of thing, but it's 10 countries, all the Southeast Asian nations. And my work was to create a report to develop recommendations dealing with migrant workers' rights. And since currently the Philippines is one of the main sources of domestic care work. Filipino women primarily doing this kind of work in the world. A lot of my work had to do with the rights and welfares of migrant living domestic workers. I also had the opportunity as part of this project to meet with civil society groups and other organizers who work on the front lines with migrant workers. It was a real departure from the work I was doing at the AHRC because most of the work I did in the AHRC was very specialized. It was examining domestic and regional legal protections, statutory protections for these workers, but there really was a sort of distance between how these rules actually played out in people's lives and the sort of law, the high law work I was doing in the office. And so I was lucky to talk with some of these workers and to record their stories once again. So there are two women that are going to be in the clip that I'm going to play for you. The first woman, her name is Shirley, and she's never lived in the same country as her children. So her oldest child is 15 years old, and she's never lived in the same country as them. So basically, she sends money back to them every month. The second woman you'll hear speaking, her name is Rowena, and she's 27 years of age. She's actually younger than I am, and she had to drop out of university to go and earn money for her 9 brothers and sisters. So I'm just going to play the clip. So when I was there, I learned a lot firsthand the sort of conditions that these women face. For Shirley, for example, she wasn't receiving enough food to eat, and she was expected to work basically 24 hours a day for an elderly person. For Rowena, she worked in factories in Taiwan, and she had better working conditions, but now she's ready to go off and to do domestic work because the current economic climate did not allow for her to continue working in a factory. So the last lesson that I learned was just about the difficulty of sort of pushing the boundaries of what gender entails. So in the Philippines, when we talk about gender, we're talking specifically about women's empowerment and discrimination against women. But when I was in the Philippines, I had the pleasure of working on a collaborative paper with my supervisor on transgender rights and family law. This project was very interesting for me because it showed just how difficult it was for progressive scholars to sort of highlight the situation of lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans communities in the Philippines. In the Philippines, divorce is illegal. Having sexual relations with people of the same gender or same sex is illegal. And so it was really interesting because it was actually allowing me an opportunity to contribute in supporting a community that is extremely marginalized in the Philippines. And so that was my internship. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll open up the floor to questions in just a second, and I've just put up everyone's name again, so if you want to address a specific question to one of our panelists, you have their names up here. And just to go over one last time, just to make sure that it's clear, because it sometimes can be confusing, just the nature of the award, and so the AUCC, Association for Universities and Colleges of Canada, is the organization that oversees the Students for Development Award, and the award is funded through support from CETA, and then partner universities are the ones who then are responsible for working directly with the students in order to prepare them for their internships. So the award in itself is the Students for Development Award. It's just administered by the Association of Universities and Colleges, and McGill is one of many universities that participates in this program. And as I mentioned before, information about the award will be made available on our website as soon as it's confirmed. And just before we open up to questions, I also wanted to let you know that we will have a reception after the question and answer period, and we also have, I think, one other student from a previous year who also received the award. So in addition to our eight panelists, there's also Mark McEwen, who's just sitting up there, who last year received the Students for Development Award to work for the Center for Democratic Development in Accra, Ghana. And he was a graduate of the Faculty of Arts and is now in his first year in law as well. But for now, if you have any questions for the panel, we'd be happy to take them. Hey, Mark.
Is that on? Yeah, okay. Yes. A question for the three of you that were speaking about governance. You mentioned legitimacy, and often a flip side to that is seen as being accountability, either between the type of organizations that you were working with or between the government and citizens. So I was wondering if your internships touched on that at all, and if so, how it did.
Well, I'll just speak for the ICTR. I know, like, it wasn't something that was directly related to my work, but something that I learned as I was there and becoming familiar with sort of the climate is that a lot of people in Rwanda don't necessarily support the ICTR for various reasons, and there's been conflict between the Rwandan government and the United Nations, which was actually my third point of that I had forgotten to mention. So that's definitely an issue, and I think that's a problem with governance generally, where it's you can never kind of find one solution that's going to suit everyone and make everyone happy. And I think in the sense that the ICTR, it's doing something, and it's the international community coming in and doing something, even if maybe it wasn't necessarily the maybe most effective way it could have addressed the genocide, or if it's not the only thing that needs to be done to address the genocide. It was one thing, and there is support for the ICTR, although there also it's like its opponents as well. So I think that's an important issue to remember, is that although it's sometimes it can be contested, it's still supported by a lot of people.
I would just say that in the context of the Refugee Law Project, when they're serving a very particular clientele, both feed into one another. I mean, the organization is not going to be legitimate without being accountable to its clientele. And the reason why there's always people hanging around and who want to see lawyers and counselors is because they do good work. And they get their accountability through making sure that they get their legitimacy, making sure that they help the clients, and the accountability comes from following that up with other people that keep coming back, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point to actually look at who are civil society groups really accountable to. And in the context of IPAC, I have to be honest. I mean, a lot of the time when I looked at the organization and how it functioned, I mean, it was supposed to be representing indigenous people all throughout Africa, but the people who were coming to meetings, who were on the executive committee, etc., were actually, in effect, a smaller elite of people who were often involved in this process and who were being sent to New York and Geneva and what have you for these big UN conferences. But the effect, the trickle-down effect of that to them and their local organizations wasn't always clear how good it was and how much indigenous people throughout Africa really, really looked to IPAC for representation. And also the fact that the secretariat, which is, you know, an unelected paid staff of the organization, did have quite a lot of leverage over the things that went on. So there is a big question of, and this is even the organization itself looks at this and grapples with this, as to how to balance functionality with real democratic principles of accountability. So I think it's a problem that all NGOs really grapple with, is who is their real constituency.
Are there any other questions? Yes.
I wanted to know,
The question was how we all found our internships and how we researched this. I guess we could all, it's all different, but we could all briefly talk about it. My internship was administrated through the Arts Internship Office here at McGill. So the Arts Internship Office has a relationship with IPAC whereby they send an intern or two every year. So for that, you'd have to apply directly to the Arts Internship Office, and you can find out information about them through ION as well.
Well, it's the same for Justin and May and I at the Faculty of Law. The Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism has a human rights internship program, so we applied to the center, their internship program, and then were sent to our organizations through them.
In my case, my internship was actually part of a field study semester for 3 months, and so that was an integral component. Part of coursework, so it was, again, 3 months, and that was the Barbados Interdisciplinary Tropical Studies field semester.
Mine was also administered through the Faculty of Arts Internship Office, and I would just say that I happened to see it and decided that it was something that I couldn't pass up. It was just a good fit for me, so I would look carefully through what's posted or during research.
With my internship, I actually worked with the NGO before I came here to McGill. So, and I wanted to go back because I felt I could do more going back to an organization that I already knew.
I saw an ad for it in the Arts Lounge in Leacock about a month before school was ending and had nothing else to do. Yay, economic crisis. And saw the words Beekeeping Rwanda Widows and was like, yes, let's do that. So that's good. Any more questions?
There's a question up here.
Hard to handle in terms of immediate needs. So the question is, how do you take the avenue in different countries of environmental sustainability when there's such a pressing need of economical access? Is sustainability, environmental sustainability, something you can sell by yourself, or it always has to be associated with an economic development component?
I think it's actually a case of both. What I was trying to indicate through my story was sometimes you can overcome that hurdle with more enlightened person or more experimental person. You bridge the gap. But how they become more experimental, that's uncertain. Like in our case, this guy, he had a lot of his children were migrant workers, so they brought back new ideas from the city, and he had a higher level of education than most. But I think it's also a question of when economic development reaches a certain point where it starts to impact the environment of the people, and so they see their income diminishing or they see their livelihoods directly threatened, then they're more likely to take action on it. But the problem there is, do they take action by protesting against the people who are causing environmental degradation, or do they take action in their own lives at the same time to actively stop damaging their environment?
And just to sort of further that a little bit more, environmental sustainability and economic advancements of different sorts, as I mentioned, actually they go hand in hand because good environmental governance can actually promote savings, again, in, you know, for instance, food costs or in energy savings by supplementing through natural means, wind energy, hydroelectric projects of the sort. So I don't think the two trajectories are not necessarily separate, except in the traditional model of development that have been adopted by many different nations by trying to follow suit with the Western countries. So it's not quite as sort of black and white as sometimes the media and politicians try to make it seem.
I think it's an issue you have to look at within specific situations, and you can't really take an aggregate for the reason that environmental resources are unequally distributed. So the amount of economic growth that can be accomplished through, let's say, environmental projects or the amount of environmental degradation depends greatly on where exactly you are. The only example I would say is that in my experience in Kenya, there are certain areas that have very good micro-hydroelectric resources but are and are also uneconomical to develop for the national grid, so it makes sense to have micro-hydro projects there. In other places, it doesn't. I think it's very difficult to examine that in any broad sense. I think you have to take a specific approach.
Yes. In the back, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think one thing that the ICTR has tried to do is that the third official language of the tribunal is Kinyarwanda. So, for example, when you attend proceedings at the tribunal, often they will be in Kinyarwanda, and then there will be translation. And if anyone is speaking English or French, it's always also translated into Kinyarwanda. But I do think that is sort of it's been an ongoing problem with the ICTR, in fact, in terms of relating to the local population, and I think that the ICTR needs to try harder to liaise with community groups that represent, like, widows groups, for example. There was a lot of collaboration between the ICTR and widows groups in the beginning, and then a lot of the widows groups became kind of disenchanted because they felt that it wasn't really meeting their needs, or that they weren't being adequately protected when they were testifying and that sort of thing. So I think that if they could reach out more to community groups, then that would be one solution.
Yeah, just to kind of rephrase the question briefly, it was basically asking how to reconcile, like, how to bring this high flow and legal terminology and language from the international organizations to local levels to help people really relate to it. And I think that was a lot of what IPAC actually tried to do when we had our human rights training meeting in Bamako. We basically had an international lawyer come and just step-by-step explain the process of bringing a human rights complaint to the African Commission, for example, and how that would happen. So even just helping people access the expertise of people like lawyers requires for them to understand how these mechanisms work, which is often something that even, you know, regional instruments like the African Commission don't spend much time on. You know, they kind of put it up on some really dysfunctional website in only English and French, and then, you know, and it's in language that a lot of people who haven't had maybe more than a primary education might not really understand. So I think it's a very good, it's probably one of the fields where NGOs can really have a lot of impact, because they bridge that gap between those intragovernmental organizations that don't really have expertise in this, and, you know, they're kind of the middleman between the two. So it's a good question.
Another thing I forgot to mention was that the ICTR implemented a program to bring young Rwandan jurists to work at the ICTR, which I think is effective in sort of helping to sort of bridge the gap between the local community and the work of the tribunal.
Okay, yeah, we have one last question.
Okay, so my question sort of touches upon what has been mentioned before, but Jacob talked about the fact that you need to deal, obviously, well, not to deal, but to work with the local communities to make things work. You also talked about it by saying that the leadership of this man was very important in the implementation of the projects. So I guess my question is, to what extent do you think that the initiatives that you have been involved with, or any initiative in developing countries but stemming from Western countries, need to be rooted in, an efficient and important local leadership?
Is it okay? What was interesting about our NGO was originally it was an international organization, but it had been in China for 20 years. Most of its staff was Chinese, and it insisted on working through either local environmental groups or through Chinese universities. So a lot of the work was owned by different sectors of Chinese society. The question then is, well, what does the NGO do? Does it just provide money. Well, in our case, not really, because we also took, the NGO is international, so it took experience of community development from other countries and applied it to training programs in China while taking in the input of local organizations. But I completely agree with you that local ownership is crucial, and also people who go abroad to work with NGOs should make a big effort to either learn the language or learn the local.
I know that there are many more questions for the panelists, but I think maybe the best thing would be to take advantage of the reception to kind of come up to them individually and ask them questions, because I know that many people have questions and want to know more about individual experiences, and that's what they're here for, is really to answer your questions as best they can. So there's just a small reception in the atrium, so we invite you to join us there and to ask the panelists all of your questions there. Thank you.